This is Kathleen Stevenson for KBOO. I'm speaking with Eliza Griswold. She is an award-winning investigative journalist and a fellow at the New American Foundation. She is also a poet. Eliza Griswold spent 7 years in the villages and slums along the 10th parallel, a line of latitude 700 miles north of the equator. She writes about her experiences in the new book, The 10th Parallel, Dispatches from the Fault Line Between Christianity and Islam. Eliza Griswold, thanks for coming into KBOO.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us about this line of latitude. What makes it a geographic and ideological front line?
Well, I really began with this statistic that 4 out of 5 of the world's 1.3 billion Muslims are not Arabs. They don't live in the Middle East. They're Africans and they're Asians. And it's here that that massive community of believers meets with a little less than half of the world's 2 billion Christians. And this is an encounter. I mean, I think of, you know, lat as flat. That helps me with latitude is horizontal. So beginning at the equator and looking north to the line 700 miles to the north, which is the 10th parallel, here in Africa and Asia, across 9,000 miles, Christianity and largely meet. And it is an encounter driven largely by wind and other forms of weather. In Africa, this space between the equator and the 10th parallel has marked the southern edge of the Muslim world for more than 100 years, because it's here that the dry north, that Africa's dry north, meets the wet jungle south. And that happens right along the 10th parallel. And where the weather turns wet, tsetse flies begin to grow. And where tsetse flies grow, that meant that the Muslim traders and missionaries who traveled over the northernmost third of Africa couldn't go any farther south because their camels and their horses were killed off by the sleeping sickness that the tsetses carried. So this happened largely in the 1800s. And what happened afterwards with the arrival of European colonial powers is that some missionaries came along explicitly targeting that line to stop Islam from winning Africa. And so a lot of the language we hear these days about good and evil, salvation and damnation, is really centuries old. This is ideology that we really sowed 100 years ago in Africa, we the West. When we look over into Southeast Asia, this fault line is really the result of the trade winds, because it's here that the trade winds drop. And they dropped Christian and Muslim traders and missionaries on the same islands in Indonesia, Malaysia, and the Philippines, the same islands and beaches and ports as they did Hindus and Buddhists before that. So the Christians and Muslims, you know, in the 1500s were looking at vying over the spice trade, vying over cloves. And these days we see conflicts more over actually chocolate, crops of chocolate.
So how did you become interested in this area and this construct or this issue of the 10th parallel?
I was aware during the late 90s that this idea of the 10th parallel as the dividing line between the Christian and Muslim world, Christian-Muslim as well as Hindu and Buddhist, so that the 10th parallel marked the end of Christianity and the beginning of other faiths. This was a powerful idea in evangelical mission thinking, that this is a line to target, to reach those who haven't yet heard the gospel. So when I came across that thinking in the late 90s and early 2000s, actually I was already reporting on the Muslim world, because in 2000 I started reporting on Islam and Islamic law, Sharia, and human rights. And then right after that, so that was late 2000, and then I happened to be in New York on September 11th, and I started stringing everybody and their mother needed a stringer, a kind of cub reporter from New York. And so I started working at Ground Zero, and 2 weeks later I was in Pakistan in refugee camps with the dust of the towers on my sneakers, and already working with Islam and these kind of Christian principles of salvation. I became very interested in the idea whether the idea of absolute salvation, so the fundamentalist understanding that there's one and only one way to reach God, whether that was inherently violent. Because if there is one way to reach God, then everybody else is a sinner at best and evil at worst. And I've been very curious as how that binary division plays out on the ground.
Interesting. And you come from a family where religion has been important.
I definitely do. I come from a family where questions of faith and intellect have been asked, you know, since I was a tiny person. You know, I sometimes say that if Jesuits who are Catholic, and then so by definition celibate, if Jesuits could have kids, I'd be a Jesuit kid. So my dad was a priest when I was a small child, and I actually learned to read by reading the Bible, because it was the text most readily available to me. Not because in my family, I come from a very progressive Christian family, very, very, you know, when I was a child, religion was about like Jesus Christ Superstar and, you know, doing the crop hunger walk and service. And so, but still, the idea of faith patterning every aspect of human life was something I watched intimately in my parents' lives. And so from there, it isn't such a leap to be able to translate the experience of believers far away in Africa and Asia and the way in which they understand themselves as intimately tied to God, and to try to articulate what that means and be a translator of sorts to the rest of the world.
The basic divisions in the book and the places that you went are sort of Africa with Nigeria, Sudan, Somalia, and then Asia with Indonesia, Malaysia, and the Philippines. Is that the chronological order of your travels?
Not at all. It was hard to figure out how to structure this book. Because chronologically, I went everywhere at least twice, and it took 7 years, so there was no real rhyme or reason to my travels. I mean, when something would happen in a particular country, I would go there, and I would return to places for different reasons all the time. So what really, with my wonderful editor, two of them actually, what we ended up doing is structuring the book from west to east. So it's geographically structured from West Africa through Southeast Asia, over 9,000 miles.
The book starts in Africa, and it was Sudan where you traveled with Franklin Graham, right?
Mm-hmm.
Billy Graham's son, who had an intense rivalry with the president of Sudan. And you described these two men as believers in two opposing fundamentalisms. Can you talk about this, about how it relates to the religious divisions in Sudan and in the 10th parallel?
Sure. Well, one of the things that I was really extremely curious about is how faith and foreign policy work together in the United States. And in 2003, Franklin Graham, who is Billy Graham's son and head of about $500 million evangelical empire, was traveling for the first time in history to meet with a man who's really, he sees as the devil, a man he is called just as evil as Saddam Hussein. This man is President Bashir, who is still today the president of Sudan, even though he has been indicted by the International Criminal Court for war crimes, for his actions in Darfur. And even before Darfur, he had waged the modern world's bloodiest jihad against Christians and Muslims alike in his own country. And Graham, who has worked in southern Sudan for nearly two decades as a Christian relief worker, had seen a lot of the ways in which President Bashir made war against civilians up close. And it was here, this experience, that largely shaped his understanding of Islam. And, you know, he was very well known at this time in 2003 for calling Islam a wicked and evil religion. And so for him to be traveling to a Muslim-majority country, which is what Northern Sudan is, was extremely controversial. And the people of Northern Sudan were not so excited to see him. And for the president, you know, who espouses this very hardline Islamic ideology, President Bashir wanted Franklin to come because he wanted to curry favor with the West. He was afraid that after Afghanistan and Iraq, Sudan would become the next rogue Muslim regime on the U.S. hit list. So for him to have the man known as the personal pastor to George W. Bush, who is Franklin Graham, it was a smart political move. And so Graham went to sit down with this man, really his sworn enemy. And what happened is the two men tried to convert one another to their respective faith, and that didn't go over terribly well. And then Graham leaned forward, and he began to talk to Bashir about his own hospital. One of the realities, the British split Sudan, which is Africa's largest country, along the 10th parallel in 1904. And they made it illegal for Christian missionaries to work among Muslims in the north. They'd face some bad rebellion at the hand of Islam in the north, and so they said to the Christian missionaries, you guys go south of the 10th parallel and don't work among Muslims. Well, Franklin Graham's work in the south is really the legacy of that colonial history. And so he now has the largest hospital in the south at a place called Louis. And when he was talking to Bashir, he leaned forward and said, Mr. President, I understand you know about my hospital at Louis. And Bashir said one and only one sentence in English during his whole meeting. And he turned to his aide and he said, isn't that the hospital we bombed? Talking about his own government and their attempts to attack Franklin Graham's hospital. And Franklin said, yes, twice, and you missed. So with that, the rest of us were ushered out of the throne room. And the two men continued to talk. And Graham told me later that he remembered he had a George W. Bush 2004 re-election pin in the blazer in the pocket of his blue blazer. So he reached into his pocket and he pulled out this pin and he gave it to President Bashir and he said, Mr. President, I understand you'll be speaking to my president later on today. Why don't you tell him you're his first voter here in the Sudan? So what was that about? That was really about Franklin Graham showing the president of Sudan that he was close with the American administration and therefore needed to be taken seriously. On the other side, what that looks like, and that has looked like historically to many of these 4 out of 5 Muslims in the larger Islamic world, is that the West is explicitly Christian. Because it isn't only this one encounter with Graham, that's only a one small snapshot of the reality that until the past couple of decades, the idea of secular rights or relief work or aid work, the UN even, that wasn't tied explicitly to Christian missionaries, didn't exist. Aid work in Africa and in Asia has been Christian for as long as it's existed. Mm. So, you know, that's something that we in the West really have to remember, that how is it that Muslims see us? Well, they see the West as explicitly Christian in part because of this heritage of mission work. And so that was very much, especially these days as things get more and more heated between us, is very much something that I want to make sure that I have done and continue to do, is make sure that as much as I understand it, as much as I've heard the world's Muslims talk about how they see the West, make sure that I bring those messages back here so that other people can hear them too.
Mm-hmm. And you did end up praying with Billy Graham's son, with Franklin Graham, and you have a passage in the book about this.
Yes, I sure do. Sure. I will go ahead and read that.
Okay. I'm speaking with Eliza Griswold. She is an award-winning investigative journalist and a fellow at the New American Foundation. Her new book is called The Tenth Parallel, Dispatches from the Fault Line Between Christianity and Islam.
So while I was in Sudan with Franklin Graham and his team, the question came up of what my own beliefs were. And I was asked by one of the men who works with Franklin Graham what my background was. And I said to him, that question confused me a little bit. And I explained that I came from Philadelphia. And he said to me, that's not what I meant. Was I a believer or not? Salvation was absolute, saved or damned. There was no in-between. Which was I? To me, the question of faith required a more complex answer. I was raised as the daughter of an Episcopal priest, and I grew up in a rectory in suburban Philadelphia during the 70s and 80s, a particularly progressive moment for the church. Worship included Passover Seders, Jesus Christ Superstar, and doing the crop hunger walk, as well as gathering around an altar and eating homemade organic wheat bread at the Eucharist. This was the bustling, clamorous world of public religion. Talking and listening to God involved a quiet conversation, and words, I was sure, were the way to reach his ear. For me, as a 6-year-old girl, going out to play often meant sneaking next door to the dark, cool church. I learned to read by standing at the pulpit and practicing the Bible's cadences out over the empty pews. I saw the Bible sitting open on the brass lectern, a red satin ribbon marking the page as a book of spells, one whose extravagant metaphors, whose terrible and powerful parables were ways to call God down to earth. In college, 15 years later, I read the work of the 20th century Romanian historian and theologian Mircea Eliade. when I came across this concept of hierophany, the spaces where the sacred and secular worlds meet, and people's attempt to create them through ceremony, I understood what I had been up to as a child. At Sunday school, a boy my age once asked me if my father was God. "No, he's God's best friend," I replied. I saw my loving, distant, distractible father caught between two worlds. One was a place of worldly decisions and unexpected telephone calls. I watched him rip the rectory's black rotary phone right off the wall. The other was a sacred realm in which he was a servant, not a leader. When I was 12, he was elected the Episcopal Bishop of Chicago, and so we moved from a Philadelphia suburb to the urban shore of Lake Michigan. At his consecration, the rite in which a person formally offers himself or herself to God as a bishop, my father, following long tradition, lay face down on the cathedral floor with his legs extended and arms outstretched, his body forming the shape of a cross. There was something about this act of utter surrender that terrified and angered me. What right had God and the several thousand Midwestern strangers in the pews to demand my father's life? "When are they going to let Dad up?" I asked my mother. Although I feared for my father, I also feared for myself. What did God want from us anyway? As a teenager, I grew petrified of God's will. What if he were to swoop down and ask me to submit also? What could faith cost me? It could cost me myself, I concluded. Frankly, I was afraid God would ask me to be a nun. My father's uncompromising commitment to the articles of his faith proved difficult for me to reconcile with his progressive values and his critical intelligence. I spent those years wondering how it was that faith and intellect could work together. So what proceeds is I was there in Sudan with Franklin as a reporter for Vanity Fair magazine, hardly a bastion of religious principles. And so it had come up who my father was, and although it wasn't directly related to the reporting of that I was doing at the time, the man who'd asked me these questions and who found out who my dad was felt that it was really important for me to tell Franklin my own background. So we walked into the dining room, and when Franklin heard who I was, he had a curious reaction, and this is really it. So I sat down at the table and told Graham who my father was. Graham listened, then looked at me and flashed a smile, not the familiar high, wide public beam, but a private and mischievous grin. He and I were kin, for although we were raised with very different understandings of what it meant to be a Christian, we were also fellow PKs or preacher's kids, mottled sheep who had grown up caught between religious parents and private rebellion. But that's where our similarity ended. As far as he was concerned, the fact that I had not accepted Jesus Christ as my personal Lord and Savior meant I was going to hell. "There's no middle ground. Salvation is black and white," Graham told me. He had made this choice for Christ. Why hadn't I? He turned to me and asked, "If your plane crashes tomorrow, are you absolutely sure you'll go to heaven?" I thought for a moment and told him, "No." "Would you be willing to pray with me now?" he asked me. So that's a little taste of that. That section is a bit different than the most of the book, since most of the book in Nigeria, Sudan, Somalia, Indonesia, Malaysia, and the Philippines is not personal. Mm-hmm. I mean, in that it doesn't use a first person, and that section does. Because what I found, you know, in terms, we've really watched the death of objective journalism mm-hmm. in the past decade. If there ever was such a thing as objectivity, and for me, certainly, in reporting in the cast of characters who this book is about, many who've committed violent acts in the name of religion, I had to constantly own my own subjectivity. And so the best I could do is be clear about the lens through which I was looking at people. And so that passage is probably the most effective in laying out where I come from and why it is I ask the questions that I do about faith.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about religion in this area. How much does it dominate? And it's a very general question, but I can't get super specific,
sure.
Although you might want to. Just how much does it dominate the lives of the people that are so close to the 10th parallel?
It absolutely, for most of the people to whom I spoke in the course of the past 7 years of reporting about faith and their understanding of God, that understanding God patterns their everyday lives in every aspect. And I think it's this idea of the importance and relevance of God in everyday life for Christians and Muslims alike, as well as Hindus and Buddhists and the other kinds of believers who live along this line. You know, when people talk about the developing world, I think this is one way in which that terminology simply has to die, because we assume when we use that word in terms of religious belief that, you know, people are going to move away from their religiosity, that they're developing toward us, they're developing toward a greater understanding of secularism and embracing secularism. And I don't, in my experience, that's not true at all. If anything, the world's moving toward a greater understanding and a greater embrace of religiosity.
Mm-hmm. And why do you think that is?
You know, I mean, people sometimes ask me, well, is it because of poverty? And it's certainly true that the majority of the people who live along this fault line live on less than $500 a year, right? So does poverty make people believe more in God? Well, that's a tricky one, because then you think, well, what are we saying then? That poor and ignorance is about belief? And I don't think it follows. I do think that people who have less embrace faith in a different way. I don't know, one thing in writing this book and in bringing back people's voices whole cloth, because that's what I did. I didn't really try to interpret the things that they told me. I just let them talk, because I could never judge anybody else's belief. You know, even when people had committed violence in the understanding of their belief, it wasn't for me to explain away. You know, as a reporter for secular magazines, for the mainstream media in the United States, especially after September 11th, I had editors begin to ask me, come on, does religion have any role in this upsurge of violence? And the answer is yes. And the thing that we need to do is listen more to people tell us about their own lives, as opposed to trying to constantly tease out their own context in a way that we need to let them do for themselves.
And that actually brings up a question I had about your process, because you talk to a lot of people, and you talk to a lot of different kinds of people, a lot of different parts of the social framework in the areas you visited. How did you meet them, or what was that process like?
Well, I mean, one thing that I definitely want to own is that there are many, many places along the 10th parallel where Christians and Muslims meet and live in peace. And because of the nature of this book, I was really looking at the sharpest edges of this confrontation. So I was going to places where religion had been a problem. It didn't necessarily mean that religion was still a problem in most of these places. In fact, I was really curious in how religion served as a tool to build peace after religious conflict, and it certainly does in many ways. But how I chose the people would be, you know, everywhere I went following a particular story, and whether that story was, oh, well, you know, there was a massacre in this town after a local election, or, you know, in Sudan, there's an upcoming election in January of 2011, January 9th, 2011, where the South, which is primarily Christian and non-Muslim, will have the right to vote for the first time for its own independence in a Muslim country. And so the repercussions of that, the potential for that to be Africa's bloodiest war of the next 10 years, was something I was profoundly aware of. So that fault line, the 10th parallel in Sudan, which stretches over, the country stretches over 1 million square miles, that was particularly of interest to me, because looking forward as well. So I would find people because they were already embroiled in conflict or in peacemaking in their communities. They were already vocal and leaders in some capacity in almost all cases. Certainly not, you know, I end the book with a very curious missionary, a man named Reverend Abdu. And, you know, one of my favorite pieces are people's names, because their names are such a patchwork of identities. And Reverend, he'd chosen himself to indicate that he was, you know, a priest or a religious teacher, but he'd never been to any kind of seminary or Christian kind of college, and abdu means servant or slave, and we know it in Arabic, and so we hear it in this country or in others. Abdu salam, Abdullah, which are all words that mean slave or servant of God. So here was a man who was a former Muslim who had embraced a Christian, who believed now, who was a Christian teacher, but had not left his Islamic name behind.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. The whole story that you write about him is interesting. And I even jotted down that you say, in talking about him, you say that his accommodation of conflicting worldly labels was born out of nearly 1,500 years of religious coexistence of Christians and Muslims living together. So he's a kind of a symbol of...
Yeah, he's definitely... I mean, a lot of people in the book and a lot of stories served and do serve as allegories of larger human experiences that we're getting used to here in the West, because what's happening along the 10th parallel is really a harbinger for what will begin to happen, what's already beginning to happen here. And in no point more than, you know, the single largest takeaway for me of doing this book is that the most overlooked religious clashes in the world are those inside of, not between, religions, are the wrestles between Christians and Christians and Muslims over who's a true believer and who's not. And those are the kind of competitions and power struggles that have the single most effect on shaping the future of religions. So that's something I certainly came to as a sheer result of this. And I was lucky enough when doing this book to have a pretty wide mandate. I mean, I didn't know what I was going to find. And I didn't set out to prove or disprove anything. You know, I set out, certainly, as we all are, aware of Samuel Huntington's Clash of Civilizations narrative and the idea that these two tectonic plates are, you know, in a collision course. And these would be technically what Huntington called Islam's bloody borders. This is the southern edge of the Muslim world. But what I found continually was that his thesis was oversimplified to the point of being not useful at all, and in some places promoting violence, because it was too easy to see a division between us and them, one kind of person and the other, as if we were set out as inexorable warriors toward the end, and I just don't believe that's true.
Okay, well, Eliza Griswold, it's fascinating subject matter that I think we know too little about, so thank you for your illuminating book, and thank you for talking with us today on KABU.
Thanks so much for having me.
And again, I want to let people know that I've been speaking with Eliza Griswold. She's an award-winning investigative journalist, and her new book is called The 10th Parallel, Dispatches from the Fault Line Between Christianity and Islam. This is Kathleen Stevenson for KBOO.